representing key stakeholders in the sector, meaning on the Higher Education Amendment Bill. So as you might be aware, the committee received, last time I spoke about 50, but now it's 16 written submissions on the bill. And the committee held 2 days of public hearings with 10 stakeholders, and the others decided that their written submission was enough, so they did not have to come and give oral submission or do oral submissions to the committee, and we respected their view on that one. Today, the committee is going to get a detailed analysis and responses from the department on all those submissions that were made in the presence of the department, of course, in preparation for the deliberations stages. With these a few words, I'd like to once more welcome the Honourable Minister, welcome the DG, and welcome all of you to this meeting, and we hope that indeed we will have a constructive, I repeat, constructive engagement. But also to say to honourable members, the rules that apply to the House also apply to the committee, so which means we have to conduct our business in an orderly way, making sure that we don't lose focus and then achieve on the business of this meeting. Get all those responses. Members will be allowed intervention, you know, or follow-up questions again on those responses. This is how we're going to run the business of this. We will allow the department to respond to those responses, to present their responses, and then allow the meeting to engage on further clarity questions. But before we move on to, okay, I have the item on apologies.
Minister, I did not just say apologies.
Okay, no apologies. And then, of course, we'll note all those that are not here as absent. Now, introduction. I'm checking if there's anyone who needs introduction in this meeting. We have worked together for so long that I'm even thinking that we now know who is sitting here. Or am I taking people for granted? Shall we entertain introductions, all members? No. Okay. But as long as when a person speaks, can that person introduce himself or herself so that we then at least we can take note of who made the contribution or sponsored the contribution. Okay, before we move on to item number 4, there has been a request that we get a presentation from the department on the on what is currently happening at the universities. This came as a proposal, honorable members. Honorable Member Killian.
Thank you, Chairperson. There has been a ministerial statement that was distributed to committee members, and we thank the department for distributing that to us. And because this meeting has been scheduled to get the necessary feedback from the department, I was just wondering if we're going to have adequate time. I fear because we have to really engage on the submissions made, and also then get responses from the department to what extent we should consider some of the submissions made. Chair, but may I also address on just a second issue, if you will allow
me. No, on this one, what's your proposal?
My proposal is that we stand by the agenda as was distributed.
Any seconded. Okay. Honourable Professor Pozzoli.
Can I submit that I think we must be neglecting our duty because this is a matter of national importance, and we have an opportunity with the entire department here to hear, even if briefly, a summary of the state of play in, say, the 5 or 6 universities that are in a state of crisis. Simply as a matter of information, not as a matter of debate, but simply to update the committee, and I would be very happy to have it after the presentation on responses to public comments, because I do make the point, but simply as a matter of information so that we are assured that the department is able to show us how, you know, they're on top of things and that each university is being dealt with in its own way. I don't think this is a proposal that's intended in any other way than information sharing. Thank you.
Okay. I know that when the proposal was made, we did not have the statement, which to me should serve as a summary. I haven't gone through the statement, but I'm sure it's a summary of what is happening. And then maybe we propose that in the next meeting, we request a full report on what is happening at the university and there's somebody who's speaking, but I can't see and I can't hear you. And you know there's a way of speaking in our meeting. Are you saying something, Honorable Member Mbada?
They just rap whistle without it.
Okay. Firstly, it must be noted, I wasn't even been aware that the request was made by Honorable Bozul.
What difference does it make?
It doesn't matter. What I'm trying to say is, I thought maybe it was made by an ANC member, but I thought maybe as an issue of interest. It would be important to things are happening out there. Parents are assembling in universities, beating black students in the name of defense of some language. And I mean, we might be gladly quiet if that's what we are.
Okay, Honorable Member Gekana, I know we are debating whether to have this item or not to have this item, but at the end, you know, I have to rule on the matter.
Yes, so when you rule, maybe you can consider that if after the presentation is done, if there is still time, we can get the brief on condition that it is just a brief information and we don't go into the theatrical part of it of everybody wanting to do a political dance about it. So if it is just a brief and we close the meeting, that's fine.
Okay. There is a... Okay, Honorable Professor Bozoli is supported. And supported... there was also a support by Honorable Member Mbata and then Honorable Member Keka. I don't know if we want to further debate this matter. Okay.
Chairperson, can we agree that if we do that, we insert it after the discussion on the responses so that we can conclude with that part of the meeting before we go to household matters?
Okay. Honorable Minister?
Okay, this is the point. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just wish to point out that I have submitted an apology to be released by 12, which means, therefore, if by that time I have not reached this item, I must not be accused of running away from wanting to discuss the briefing. I will have to leave that with the DG on the item. I would like it to have been here, but I had submitted that I need to leave here as this is another very urgent matter I've got to attend to. Thank you very much.
Okay, I've made some observations from the chair. I just want to request members that when we discuss this serious matter pertaining to education, we rise above our political, political ideologies, and just rise above and assist in finding solutions for this nation. I think that will help. I think that will help because we need to find the best solutions that will take the country to greater heights. So I appreciate. And I have asked you, as you recall, from the very beginning when we started, we cannot politicize education. We can just rise above it with assistance. All of us, cutting us off. Thank you. Thank you very much. Shall we then move on to item number 4 and get responses to the Department of Higher Education and Training on the Higher Education Amendment Bill, Bill 36 of 2015. Yes,
Ms. Kilian? I just wanted to have clarity on the second issue that I wanted to have information on. You have indicated that we've received another submission. Just by way of understanding our process, was there a deadline that was set in the advertisement so that we know by the time that we go into the deliberations on the detail of the bill that we know the submission period has come to a close? Otherwise, it is an endless process and we will not be able to really apply our minds to all submissions. So if you can just clarify that, please.
Okay, we received a submission from SALS after the closing date.
Chairperson, that it is just important for us to then just make sure that we minute that, because I know that there has been successful challenges in court about Parliament's management of the processes of passing bills.
Okay.
So we must just deal with the detail very carefully. So can we minute it as such? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we take note of the proposal made by Honourable Member Kilian. Shall we then proceed with the presentation by the department? Honorable Minister?
Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe just by way of a few introductory remarks really, before we hand over to Advocate Kosso, who is our legal president of the department. First of all, although it is normally said, Chair, that you must not thank a fish for swimming, but I would like to thank the portfolio committee for its deliberations. I'm saying that because it is, and the legislation is your responsibility, but nevertheless, one wishes to express appreciation, especially also in terms of conducting public hearings. Which is always very helpful and informative. And we also benefit from that as the department that has originated this piece of legislation. I don't have to go back to what the bill is about, because I'm sure now, say, even if you can be woken up at 12 midnight and you are asked what this bill is about, you will just be able to articulate that, because you've been going through it in the manner that you have. I think it is important that we remind ourselves that as you move towards finalizing it, that in terms of higher education policy in our country, we don't just speak of institutional autonomy on its own. We talk about institutional autonomy and public accountability, because these are public institutions. Sometimes there is this one-sided emphasis. I know that it's not an easy balance, because some tend to emphasize one over the other. I just think that it's important that we do that. And also that the aim really was to clarify a number of things in terms of administrative justice, as well as cater for some gaps that have been there, that we've identified. It isn't really a comprehensive review or amendment of the Higher Education Act, because we're still going to do that, especially in the light of the fact that we are finalizing that hopefully by March next year. We are working on a comprehensive national plan for post-school education and training, which indeed will require a comprehensive look at all the pieces of legislation that fall under, that are a responsibility of our department for purposes of implementation. As I said, Chair, the public hearing process has been very commendable, and we have studied very carefully and looked at the submissions, and we also note the concerns that have been raised, especially by the students and the trade unions that we had not really adequately consulted them. We take that point. But nevertheless, we are pleased that generally they are in support of the thrust of the legislation. We will make sure in future that we do indeed consult beyond just university management and so on. And we have, of course, noted the impassioned submissions by, among others, the High Education Network, COSATU, NEHAL, FACP, Transformation Stellenbosch Group, and SAUS. And as I say, we have looked quite comprehensively into all the submissions. And I thank the Chair once more for the opportunity of engaging the Portfolio Committee, and I'm looking forward to the outcomes of the deliberations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. I will now cross over to Advocate Boshoff.
Thank you, Chair. It is quite a daunting task to try and summarize 16 different submissions, and we apologize also that the department's slide is consisting of quite a voluminous bundle. We try to be as complete and address the issues as accurate and as possible, and therefore we will also, in order to save some time, elaborate only on specific of the slide. The honourable members do have the slide in their position and can obviously use that to raise specific questions, but that's purely for the sake of time. We are very worried that it might take too long to deal with each slide in full extent. Just as an introductory remark, the first one on the order of slides is that of the South African Parastatal and Tertiary Institution Union, SAPTU. This union, obviously, were very appreciative of the bill and supported most of the content thereof. And they focus on their specific revisions that deals with conditions of service relating to the members, also transformation goals and oversight mechanisms, the ministerial directives and intervention options that are provided for in the legislation and in the bill where it is addressed and refined in procedural and other aspects, and also deals with the broader administrative burden or the increased administrative burden it will have on the institutions. The department response to these four critical issues is that when it comes to the comments relating to the transformation goals and the oversight mechanism, it is important to highlight that this is an amendment act which is providing an amendment to the existing provision. Although this amendment bill is referring to the language of section 3.1, it is not in the bill itself, but it is a very important provision, and that is where the role of the CHE is prescribed by law as a very important function, and the minister cannot make policy unless the minister consults with the CHE. And if you read that section with section 5 of the Act, where the CHE, when they give advice to the minister obviously
may elect not to follow the advice, that then the minister must provide reasons why the minister is not following the advice. So, the concept of the complaint about the role of the CAG is, I think, slightly out of context, and although it is not predominantly addressed, all those nuances I just referred to in the bill, that it is in the Act and it will form part of the framework. Chair, the other issue is raised in relation to the amendment. The determination of the scope and range of the policy is already in section 3, sub 3D. But with the restructuring of that of the specific subsection, the language that was used is to introduce the word appropriate oversight mechanism, which also raised some concerns. The department obviously considered the context, and although it was not prominently raised, the stem of section 3, as it is currently that which referred to this open range of the transformation goals, were not actually transferred to the new provision, and the department obviously identify it also as an issue which the Honourable Committee and the members can consider as a matter that can strengthen the bill in the final analysis. The next issue that's been raised is that of the power of the minister to intervene into the affairs of a university or a higher education institution. It is also dealing with the specific concepts that lead to the intervention, that it must be an act of unfair, discriminatory, or wrongful conduct, or not that action that is required for the minister to deal with the three possible means of intervention. Now, the concept of unfair and discriminatory are concepts that most probably will be encapsulated in wrongful, and it is possible to delete unfair and discriminatory, but there's also value in it because these are the two specific terminology used in the Constitution, and the Constitution also provides a specific context within which those two concepts are liberated, and by having the three different options in the bill, it actually strengthening the proceedings. So the next issue that I raise is the declaration of interest, and that's under the theme of an administrative burden to the public higher education institution. To start with, it is a current provision in the Act. There's nothing that being in this amendment bill that is introducing new responsibilities. They are all related to the current provisions, but they are restructured, made more user-friendly, and also ordered in a specific way that bring a clear understanding of the severity of interventions and how it relates to one another. The one major concern has been that there's a huge onus on the employee to declare their interests and conflicts.
provision is currently in the Act, and it is in line with similar provisions that you would also find in the public service and in other corporate enterprises. There is a requirement that the employees that are performing a delegated function must specifically declare their functions or their interests in order for to determine if they will be suitable to perform that delegated function or not. And that's also currently in the legislation. The next issue they raised was that relating to the omission of the definition of a relative. Although there is a definition, they still raise it as a concern. It is also the definition of relative and that of spouse are obviously related in the concern they raise, and the issue of the same sex or a sexual union, which is intended to be of a permanent nature, is an aspect which they thought can strengthen the legislation, and it seems that is an aspect that the committee can consider seriously. The next issue that the union raised was that there is no clarity or definition given to the higher education college. The university being already defined, and also that of a university college, and here the definitions that have been proposed which dealt with it by way of a policy that will identify the scope and operations and which will be subjected to public process, involvement of the CHE, and also a public promulgation of the policy will provide the clarity to these specific institutional types. The aspect of the different permutations of universities that are a comprehensive, a traditional, and a typical university, those concepts are variations on the theme of a university, and it is not an institutional type. The definitions obviously is linked to policy that needs to be developed in future. It has not been developed yet, but it is an area which will be influenced by this amendment to the legislation, and it is therefore a concept which is also not totally unknown to the sector. We've got the introduction of the agricultural colleges to be transferred to your higher education and training system, and that will the vehicle that is under consideration to execute that function will be in line with the higher education colleges concept as an institutional type. Then we've also identified the difficulties of establishing a university and the practice that we use in the past of using a university college as the developmental institution in order to move to a full-fledged university, and also the dynamics that come into play with Section 29 of the Constitution, which provides that your private institution must comply with the requirement relating to a comparable public institution, and if you only got the one institutional type of universities, it becomes basically very difficult to identify an institutional type to which the private institution can be related to in terms of that provision of the Constitution. The identification of a university college and moving from a few qualifications and program offerings to a full-fledged university which provides undergraduate, postgraduate, higher education programs, research, community engagement, which needs also the criteria in order to be recognized as university, as the top layer becomes a very important aspect, and also both therefore knowledge that there is a need to deal with a conversion from the one institutional type to another one, up or down, in order to deal with the realities applicable to the system as a whole. The University of Cape Town also raised the aspect relating to Section 20, the establishment of the universities, and it is linked to what was identified by Safter. The aspect here of the conversion and the criteria is very important when it comes to also the development of your new university when they are established, and also provide in the bill a mentoring responsibility on existing university to carry it through, which I think was appreciated by the bodies making presentations. Here, the University of Cape Town also had the issue relating to discriminatory, unfair and wrongful. It has been dealt with early on. I'm not going to repeat the comments we've made. It is the same arguments. Although they raise a very interesting aspect to it, and they want to put a substantial contravention for failure to comply with any law. Now, Chair, the difficulty is who will determine what is substantial contravention of failing to comply with any law. It can only be a court of law, and therefore it would mean that the minister will never exercise his intervention power unless he first get a clarity order from a court of law, which will not only be very costly, but also becomes a very time-consuming exercise. The University of Cape Town also made comments about the revocation of any degree and diploma, and they indicated that the institutional rules are actually made to deal with this type of interventions. The problem is that in many cases the student might have already completed the studies at the university, are not subject to the university rules anymore, and therefore the rules might not be far-reaching enough to address the problem that is on the table, and therefore the legislation is a correct vehicle in order to deal with the concept of revoking a qualification. Now, the two options that the bill provides is on an erroneous action by the institution, and there's a limitation of 2 years. We'll come to an interpretation later on with the CHE, which might reiterate the provisions wrongly, but the other option is that of fraudulent qualifications. So if it is due to plagiarism or fraudulent aspects, then that qualification will be withdrawn and there's no time frame attached to it. When it is due to the fault of the institution, then there are so many permutations, because students could honestly believe that he or she complied with all the requirements applicable to their degree, continue with the studies, and also receive further qualifications, and it becomes a major problem. So the limitation of a 2-year is a reasonable time frame in order to correct the wrong, but also provide the prescription period which is justified in our opinion. The one aspect which we speak up is not raised, but it was actually prompted by the discussion, and the issue of the bill is silent on notifying SAHWA and the respective QC on the revocation of a qualification, which is a critical omission, because your national learner database is the official qualification structure, and if there is a revocation, it should also be reflected. So here it is an aspect which the department will also propose to the committee in order for them to consider as a possible amendment. We will also touch on it later on in other slides. So the aspect of your private institutions, the revocation of qualifications under the two grounds as identified in section 65D or clause 37 obviously affects the private institutions as well, and there is a comment that has been made which carries a lot of weight that it should also be extended. The Higher Education Transformation Network provide a lot of information about higher education as a whole, but in general they were, other than support, no real issues related to the bill itself, and we are not going to spend too much time on analyzing their comments. Obviously the committee, the honorable members, will also take into account the issues they raise. The CHE is a very important constituency. The aspects that they raise of the transformation goals, they were, and the policy relating to that and the oversight mechanisms, they were supporting it. They were also dealing with the oversight mechanisms, and that it is important to deal with the current situation by providing a proper framework within which transformation can be steered, and where the different role players can identify roles and responsibilities. The CHE also supports the ministerial interventions, the issue of accountability versus good governance, and is a very important concept which they supported, and they also qualified it that it is without interfering with the autonomy and academic freedom of institutions of higher learning, and it is important that those interventions must be instituted timely in order to prevent an institution to become dysfunctional. The National Qualifications Framework and the legislation and regulations that is currently in place must be reviewed in order to address some of the critical issues that is also in place, and the role of the CAE in advising the minister on the policies that will and the regulations that will follow out of that has also been highlighted. The issue of private institutions, the CHE raised the concern that the private institution must also have a Senate as the highest decision-making structure on academic and research matters. Now, Chair, it becomes a very interesting aspect what is the role of the Senate when it comes to the operational corporate governance function of a money-making institution. And the view of the department is that it might have some risk if that is prescribed in law. There might be other similar structures that they can consider, and that is possible by way of the registration process and the regulations that the minister can provide if there is a need for that. So the withdrawal of qualifications, I've already alluded to, the CHE misread it. They acknowledged that the comments they made about the time frame to fraudulent qualifications was not as it is reflected in the Act, and I'm not going to spend time on that. Chair, they've also identified a omission by referring in Section 65D1 to the HEQF instead of SF, and Chair, that is an oversight which the committee could also consider as an important amendment. Chair, with regard to the CIE, the Institute, the Catholic Institute of Education, is very supportive of the bill. They are also very appreciative of the amendments to the chapter on the registration of private higher education institutions, and Chair, they expressed themselves on a number of issues, the policy aspects, the different institutional types, which obviously also relates to the different institutional types that might be used in the registration of your private providers. Although there were slight criticisms on semantical issues, but in general they were very appreciative of the approach taken by the bill. They also raised the issue of the definitions and if I can then move to the University of Universities of South Africa, or USAS, there's at least five of the universities structures, which includes the USOF, that carry the same theme. They also raised the same issues that was raised by University of Cape Town, which I've already dealt with in full, as well as the union. I'm not going to repeat all the issues that has already been addressed in order to save some time, but the slides will identify if it's the same issues that has been identified. The issue of the qualifications, already alluded to earlier on, that they raised it very sharply that the qualifications of your public must also be extended to your private institutions, which I've already indicated is a good proposal, which carries a lot of weight. If I can move to the next issue that I raised, that of the errors we've discussed when it comes to the 2-year period, when it is error of the institution, they were in support of that, and they were in line with the interpretation of the department. So the amendment of the presentations of Kusatu and Nihabu, they were very strong in support of the bill. They view the bill as striking a balance between ensuring accountability of the public higher education institutions and the protection of the institutional autonomy as well as the academic freedom. Regarding the investment of your higher education institution funds, the department noted the concerns they raised. However, the department believes that the proposed amendment adequately addresses most of their concerns at least at this stage, and it will be impossible to legislate all possible unforeseen circumstances as they've suggested. There are some of the issues that one must also take into account is that your retirement provisionings, the funds relating to that, are investments that is also under the control of the institution, and you prohibit it as all investments must be prohibited can create a problem. For just to use that as one of the examples, they are a need to provide a regulated framework within which investments can take place, and the bill has addressed it by using acceptable and recognized financial instruments as the solution they do. So the issue of accountability directly to Parliament through the annual reports, the department believes that the accountability mechanisms currently in place are adequate for your public institutions to account to the minister and to the department, and that report also are discussed and by this committee and are dealt with in full. The next presentation was that of the Independent Institute of Education. Once again, they welcome the bill. They've got a similar line of which they introduce than that of the Catholic Institute, and very much addressing similar issues. Obviously, they are also welcoming the amendments to the private institutions and the issues relating to that aspect. The department noted the concern regarding the provision of clause 35 the in order to address the concern, the department proposes to insert that the provision that is applicable to the public institutions will also apply with the necessary changes to your private higher education institution, which is an aspect which had also been addressed by some of the previous inputs. The transformation Stellenbosch also provides a submission which obviously support the bill, but dealt with other relevant issues, which is relevant to our higher education system, but not necessary to issues directly related to the bill. And in order to save time, we've got a slide on the different issues that they raised, and also dealing with the definition of racism. The department just wanted to draw the attention that there are other legislation already in place, which is Promoting of Equality and the Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act of 2000, which already deals with this aspect in detail. The ministerial directives and the word they use or want to use is that of instruction. The Honourable Member Ms. Gillian identified that there's a similar meaning, and we support the views that the Honourable Member expressed when she addressed that issue in the presentation. The inadequate consultation with students on the bill has been raised by the South African Union of Students, as well as the Congress of the People Student Movement. Department noted the concern that believe that the voice of the student was heard during the public hearings on the bill through both written and oral submissions by their respective organizations, and that they've raised very important issues. They've also welcomed the bill. With minor concerns, one issue that the COPISM raised is that the chapter on the National Institutes for Higher Education should be deleted. I think it might be a misunderstanding of what is the role of our education institution versus that of our education institute. The two are not overlapping one another. The institute is in support of the education institution on specific focus identified in the establishment of that institute, whilst our education institution is the delivering of qualifications within the mandate of that institution. The South African Communist Party also provides a submission. There's once again support for the bill, and they acknowledge that there is a balance between the institutional autonomy and the public accountability, which is a very important aspect in order to create a coherence in the system. The institutional autonomy, academic freedom, and public accountability is upheld in the bill, according to their understanding of it, and also it is in according with the South African law as it stands, and it is identifying the requirements of fair administrative justice and governance, which is important when it is dealing with higher education institutions and universities in particular, also in they exercising their institutional autonomy. The concerns they raise were that it falls outside the scope of the current legislation, and it is not directly linked to this amendment bill. The bill will, the department will take concerns into consideration when further legislation is deliberated, and Minister already alluded to that. The University of Technology, they also sent a presentation. They didn't present in themselves. The concerns that they raise are similar in nature to that of the other universities, also dealing with the issue of autonomy and the accountability, counterbalance thereof, and the interventions that may erode the institutional autonomy, which is a position which is not necessarily supported by all, but it is a view that is common theme by all the universities. The University of Northwest University, also sent a presentation that they did not present it to the committee. Once again, they welcome the provisions. They raise similar issues than what is already used or that we discussed in the USAF presentation, and therefore, in order to save time, what I said in relation to that submission is also applicable here. They proposed amendments to the specific sections that I've already identified in the previous analysis of especially the submission of USAF that is relating to Section 3, relating to Section 42, and that of Section 49B sub 1 and 27 and Section 36 of the Act. The responses is that it is desirable for higher education institutions to enjoy and acknowledge freedom and autonomy in their relationship with the state, but within the context of public accountability. And that balance, as the Minister already indicated, that is a very important balance, and which requires that the legislation address a structure where the autonomy of the institutions are respected, and even with the interventions, the Minister is not taking over any of the functions at any stage. It is there's a role to ensure that the integrity of the Constitution and the constitutional principles and the functionality of the institutions are adhered to, and the intervention is to provide independent parties to take over an investigation in the case of independent assessor, and in the case of administrator, the administrator is not from the, is not a minister or from the department, from but from an independent source, will then perform the functions of that university in order to bring that university back to functionality. University make a few proposals, which I think is in line with all the discussions we've had. Stellenbosch University also provides a similar proposal. It is basically addressing the same issues as that of USAF. In order to deal with the time constraint, I'm just going to identify a few very short issues, or allude to a few issues in brief. The first thing is they want a restructuring of the definitions, which is an issue that one can consider. It is not going to make a difference to the substance, but it can address the user-friendliness of the bill. It's the issue of Section 3. It's we've already dealt with that in detail. Then there was a presentation from Mr. Sisiki. He's the chairperson of the Ingwe Tiva College. Mr. Sisiki supported the bill. He also in favor of the amendments to the Institutional Forum, which requires that the University Council must consider and identify reasons if they don't follow the advice when the Institutional Forum provide advice on any specific aspect within their domain. I also raise the issue of the 50% residence clause, which falls outside the scope of the bill, and obviously the department will take that into consideration when the Higher Education Act policies will be determined through a process of consultation. The one aspect that Mr. Sisiki also raised sharply is that in terms of Section 3.3c, he suggested that to determine articulation and recognition of our learning qualification framework across the education and training system so that it is even wider than just the higher education system. It is a view that your policy that the minister made will obviously affect also the broader system, but it may not focus within the scope of the Higher Education Act, which is the application of the broader policy framework within the higher education institutions. The South African Union of Students, they raised the issue of a declaration of university reserves and more particular those institutions who directly benefited from the apartheid subsidies for a direct funding, or as it should be used for direct funding for free higher education in South Africa. They also want to get these, they feel that and call for amendment to for a listing of all reserves of this institution in the Division of Revenue Act for equal distribution to needy students. They also view there must be emphasis on the effective accountability of the public funds, that the higher education institutions should also comply with the PFMA. One important aspect of the Public Finance Management Act is an act which is considered to be a money act, as is identified in the Constitution, is under the domain of the Minister of Finance, and also follows a different procedure than any other legislation. So any amendments to that act cannot be accommodated in the Education Act or by this committee. The students also propose for the Skype a number in the institutions to be increased, which is once again an aspect which is not
dealt with in the bill, but it obviously it would mean a disturbances of the numbers of a council, which is already a 50 members, and it can also disturb the 60-40% ballots of external internal members, which can basically, if you do additional internal members, it will have a follow-through effect also to the external members. Most of the issues there is fourth outside the parameters of the current bill. In conclusion, the department wanted to firstly wish to thank the portfolio committee for the opportunity afforded to make the submission, and also the various role players who put their position, and the department is also contributed to the various organizations as well as the students who needed the call to prepare these presentations. Thank you, Chair.
I just wanted to ask, are you running on pages or are you running on slides?
Pages.
The two slides, okay. Thank you. I would like to thank you for the opportunity. This applies to the department's response to the transformation goal issue in all the presentations where it comes up, so it's not just the page. And I just want to thank the department for their reassurance that the intention of the bill is not an invasive one, which is intended to restrict university autonomy, but that it's more about public accountability, although I do remember the point made by UCT, which is that everyone accepts the balance. We all accept that institutional autonomy and public accountability are the two sides of the same coin, and they need to be considered together. But I think the view of some of the submissions was that the balance might be being pushed in one direction and away from institutional autonomy by some of the provisions in this Act, one of which, as you know, as we discussed last time, is the determination of the scope and range of transformation goals and oversight mechanisms. And we also coupled that with Clause 42, which I don't think is entirely dealt with in this response. So what I would like to ask the department, not the legal division so much, how do you actually visualize this taking place? Let's say the Act is passed with the clause in it. What happens next? Does the minister then sit down and say, I now want this following university to have the following transformation goals, and I'm going to consult the CHE, and then they come up with goals, and then oversight mechanisms are set up. What kind of mechanisms would those be? And what happens if you don't meet these goals? Is Clause 42 then activated, and the minister can intervene, saying, well, you didn't meet the goals that I set, therefore you are now going to have a directive and are taking over your university. Now, I know that the department says that it's not intending this, but this could be read as a worst-case scenario arising from the way the bill is formulated at present. So if I could just get some clarity. Thank you.
And Mr. Friendly, I'd like the department to respond to this one in particular. So as and when we hear the response.
No, thank you very much. The manner in which the department is relating to our institution is mainly through engagement. The question of the transformational goals, it's not basically the conception or imagination by the department. These are the issues that we engage with institutions and all stakeholders at the respective higher education summits. In 2010 as well as in 2015, October, where a determination was made by all stakeholders that instead of just talking generally about transformation, let's make a determination of the key goals that would actually be a determinant of how an institution would look like if it is transformed, both in terms of the quality of provision in our institution and ensuring that there is a balanced representation, you know, across the city. So these are matters for engagement with institutions. Then the process of those engagements would actually determine as to how the matter should be taken further in terms of applicable resources in the system.
Thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up question, Professor Pozzoli?
Yes, thank you very much, TG. So, in a way, what you're saying in relation to the engagement with the institutions, that might be a phrase that we could include in the clause to reassure people of the anxieties that they have about invasion of the autonomy, that in consultation with institutions and the VHE, transformation goals would be set.
No, the legislation enjoins the minister to put to the attention of the council of the university on any matter that he feels is not receiving adequate attention by the institution. And the engagement ensue on those bases. It's not a question of just, you know, walking from one institution to the other and saying we are not meeting goals, therefore we are not meeting goals. No. It's a process in terms of ensuring that there is good governance, there is accountability to the interest of South Africa as a whole. So it's not a matter of just one sitting somewhere deciding that no, I'm not able about that or not. The matters in terms of legislation will always be put to the attention of the council, and the councils of institutions would have to pronounce themselves as to what concretely are they doing about those matters that are put to their attention.
Thank you, Honourable Member Mbata.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to warn the colleagues that let us not be in the making of the act specifically be administrative, because the intention of the act actually is to appraise the political objective of where the higher education scenario should be, including every other what we define as higher education. Under normal circumstances, a directive is reached administratively as a request or as an instruction from the ministry indicating the basically what has to be achieved. And the act must not actually specify or be worried about what becomes the directive. The act must be worried about what has to be transformed. Because those are administrative arrangements per university. And I think we're getting too much into a detail or the worrisome stuff.
Okay. We take note of your comments. Still on clarity seeking questions. Another clarity seeking question on page 3 on slide 6. My question to the department would be, why is the department agreeing to remove unfair discrimination? Because to me it's not a derogatory word. It is also in the constitution. talking about unfair discrimination. So why the sensitivity on this? But also, as we sugarcoat, people will forget that present we're dealing with discrimination in institutions of higher learning. I'm not scared to talk about those things to me. So why wrongful, softer? I think we must be straight and keep unfair and discriminatory. So people remember that we are about changing from, you know, discrimination to a better life for all. I don't see the sensitivity around the word unfair and discriminatory. Why? Remember, it's just like a two-second question. Wrongful, unfair, and discriminatory. To me, the strong words, I think, are the ones that will send the message. Not soft words. Soft words have not worked for us.
Dear, you're absolutely correct. It is three concepts that's well known in the legal precedence. It is well contained, and the issue that you are addressing of that discriminatory and unfair matters are constitutional. There's substance even in the constitution relating to that. The counter argument is that wrongful also will include those concepts, that it will not be directly addressing itself as sharply as when the three concepts are part and parcel of the legislative environment. It's the department is not feeling strong about this. The original provision was to identify the three concepts of unfair, discriminatory, and wrongful acts as the three pillars that the minister will focus on, and it is not the issue that we just raise it as a full consideration, but it is not a major problem, as you believe it is correct.
Thanks for the explanation. Page 4. Okay, is it a follow-up on this one?
Chair, it's on a different slide. My first question was on the top slide.
Oh, okay, all right. Another slide, please. Please come in.
My question is, I think the legal counsel suggested that there was a problem where the minister might have to depend on subjective judgment as to what's wrongful. I think that is what you said, where in fact that's the job of a court of law, and therefore you were worried about extending that clause. I'm not sure if it was on the slide, actually. However, your point really applies to the entire clause, Clause 42. What the clause seems to be doing is giving the minister the power to be a court of law and decide what is wrongful, instead of it being a matter for a court of law. And that is our worry about Clause 42. It says the minister will decide whether there's wrongful conduct, and then he will issue the directive. Now, what right does he have to decide what is wrongful conduct? And as Professor Pike said, a minister, not our minister, current minister, I'm sure he will never do that, but a future evil minister might decide wrongful conduct is appointing the wrong person as a vice chancellor, someone he doesn't like, and then he will say, no, you've got to appoint Mr. Zed as your vice chancellor, or Ms. Zed, and he will be perfectly within his rights, because he decides what's wrongful. That is the worry.
The department, do you want to speak? I'm not talking about EFF and DA here. I'm talking about honourable members. Excuse. Okay. Do you have a point that you would like to raise in line with the point that was raised by honourable Professor Pozzoli, Mr. Mbata? Oh, yeah, just okay. Now, the department.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and good morning to members. Firstly, I think there was a general question in regards to whether these amendments maintain the balance between institutional autonomy, public accountability, and even academic freedom.
Jefferson, I think the way that we manage and we process both is that we don't refer to the overall main or principal act. So, as the bottom explained, I mean, unfair, discriminatory, and wrongful are matters that are of concern, number one. And it's true that there's been considerable, from the universities and UF, there's been concerns. But if we look at the whole process of the act, it's quite simply that the minister on reasonable grounds must, if there's a problem, the issue of directive is not a judgment or a conclusion. The directive only starts the process in which there is, and all those matters have been covered under the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. So the issue is that a directive is not about an order, but it is around a directive for counsel to investigate, to look in, to report, etc. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Honourable Kian. It's a follow-up.
It's on this one. As a person, you see, I have difficulty because I believe that in the Principal Act, the Minister already had that ability. In fact, the current revised subsection 42 is compelling the Minister to go broader when he wants to intervene and to issue directive. He should, in fact, now, instead of just, as the previous one said, before taking action, give notice to the council, the public IAS, gets a reasonable opportunity to make the decision, etc., he should now perform a whole list of issues. He must state the nature and extent of the deficiency, and he must have the negative impact of the deficiency on the institution and all the higher education and an open democratic society. So, I mean, he's got to comply with all of that. So it's not just a carte blanche, and I don't think the concern therefore, I mean, most of the institutions who presented to us were saying the previous Higher Education Act was just so good, and why do we change it? Now we're bringing in additional conditions to comply with FIRE and the Access to Information Act, etc. I think there is more pressure that the minister must comply with specific provisions of the Act. So I would not argue that it is in fact extending his wings. I think his wings are being clipped, or he or she, whoever the occupant of the position.
So, Honourable Member Killian, you're topping up the explanation because I'm trying to check on. No, that's fine. Thank you very much, Honourable Member Ketan.
I've got two ladies next to me sleeping. I need that.
That was on a lighter note. Can we proceed?
Madam Chair, the one part that really amazes me is that when Honourable Belinda Bazzard raises the issue of the act appearing, this part that she's mentioned, appearing like the minister is giving so much power that she will replace the court. I mean, the issue of whether politicians in South Africa are above the court or not, that is a constitutional matter. There are powers that are given to our judiciary in this country, I'm just saying, checks and balances, aside that they are so strongly entrenched that nobody can change that. And there is no minister, no matter in the act, whatever he can do, that can actually substitute the court of law in this country. Ultimately, whoever wants to request anything, the minister is crossing the line. The court is always available to him to take the matter to court. So if you say, if the minister decides this is wrongful doing, as if he's a court of law, she can't pretend, she can't substitute a court of law. And that's in checks and balances, and the court is there, and it is untouchable. At all levels, the Supreme Court, Constitutional Court, and nobody can ever do away with that constitutional entrenchment of checks and balances in South Africa. So, why the fear? Because it is just there and nobody can tamper with it.
Okay. shall we make progress? I will now on to Grant Kamin, madam. That is the legal advisor for parliament. That's why I'm allowing him.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Who you? I just want, would like also to add on what has been discussed, because I want to also bring the attention of the committee to subsection 4 of the amendment, which is another check and balance. Because in that instance, it says if the minister, for example, is not directly hasn't been called by the council, then the minister can appoint the independent assessor to deal with the issue. There is also an issue of the administrator. There are many, many steps that need to be followed, which means there are many checks and balances in respect of this provision. So I think if we were to go into it and compare it with the old provision in the Principal Act, this is more comforting, so to speak, to use the language loosely. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that added information. We move on to page 3. Any clarification questions? Oh, sorry. We are from page 3 moving to page 4. Page 4, 1. Okay. Honorable Member Bata.
To check the feelings of the department around the definitions, the current definitions of spouse. Are we on the safe side here?
Next page.
It's on page 4.
No worries. It's page 4, flat number 8. Talks about the spouse of that person. So, the definition of spouse.
If you read down, Chair, the problem is people are not reading. Read down. It says slide 2.
Oh,
and under relatives. My
slide 8, right?
Yeah, of page 4 is page 2. I mean slide 2.
Okay. Just to remind you, as you do this, look at it, Mr. Mark. See this 3? I really made a mistake also here. But anyway, you say on the second slide, yeah.
Second slide.
Yeah,
page
all right. So which part are you referring to, the spouse of that person?
I'm just interested in knowing if the definitions attributed by various players, are they finding expression in the intentions of the proposed amendments, or maybe we're entering virgin territories here. Are we safe?
Right. If you may come in, advocate.
Thank you, Chair. The definition of relative referred to spouse. But if you just turn to the next slide, you will see there is a definition also of slide of a spouse that's contained in the slide, which is part of the amendment bill. And the issue that we raised was that the definition of spouse should be extended when it comes to relevance, also to include that of same sex and heterosexual unions, which is intended to be of a permanent nature. The amendment that is provided is just to add that of the heterosexual relationships to the ordinary meaning. Because definitions by nature will have the ordinary meaning unless the context of the legislation will give it a special meaning. And when you look at the traditional concept of a spouse, it would not necessarily have included the same sex and union relationship. And the concern that was raised in my understanding was that if we don't, if we provide the definition without that relationship as the concept of a spouse, it would open up a problem because in modern society it is a reality that we do have that certain type of relationships and it has the same effect as a household for a husband and wife relationship.
Honourable Member Kipian.
Thank you, Chair. I think we should perhaps note as a committee what advocate officers are saying, but I do believe that different committees of Parliament have already
dealt with the definitions, etc., etc. And I think we can learn from other exercises to make sure that we tighten up to understand what is it that we intend to regulate here. So I believe that it is helpful, but I also believe that, as Honourable Mbata has mentioned it, I think it's important because relative also refers to spouse. Now the issue is, do we have the two definitions supporting or extending each other, or are they separate definitions? You have to read them in conjunction when you read the law. You know, so in other words, if you read here the spouse of that person, does it mean the whole of the definition as contained in on slide 9? I just want to have clarity about that, but I do believe the committee will have to elaborate further and get some advice from the state law advisor as well, and our legal advisor. Thank you.
If I may, just to top up, your AUA says recognizes such in terms of the laws of the Republic or foreign country. Does this include your Income Tax Act and the Estate Duty Act? They say the laws of the Republic of South Africa. Legal advisor.
Chairperson, what I would also like to add when we're looking into defining both the spouse and relative is to, I think because of the inverted commas controversy of the case, specifically spouse, what we need to do, we need to first, the question I guess should be for the purposes of this particular legislation, what do we mean when we say spouse? For argument's sake, if you look into the income tax law, it's basically specified what is a spouse for the purpose of the legislation. So that in future, in respect of the challenge, the legal challenges, we're not faced with a situation where we seek a different definition for that particular legislation. So I think it's imperative that the department and real advisor and state advisor sit down and try to have a meaning that's going to be relevant for those purposes. Thank you.
I know it's an advice. What does it translate to? We allow them to go and work and then come back to us because the next meeting, I know we will be discussing the close-to-close, you know, this sort of legislation, close-to-close. What does it mean now? Should they, legal advisors, should they provide an answer now or they must go back and come back with an answer when we discuss the bill close-to-close? Okay, Ms. Mbata, I will take you at this point. Yes, I do want you to clarify us on that.
Chairperson, I would suggest that when we do cross by cross, we should, because the department will also be part of that process, then we will provide a response on this, we'll recommend a definition, a collective definition, then the committee will look into that and take this into consideration.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, thank you. Honourable Member Mbata, to be followed by Honourable Member Kia. Is it on the same?
Okay. I just want to advise that when considering that, the expert must also consider the definition of what is customary relation defined by other acts, so that the inclusivity here is also accommodated. I don't think it's pursuing one angle and do not look at existing legislation that has promoted all sorts of other relations.
Why do you insist on this one? I'm joking. It's all right. All right. I want to remember, Kenya.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. I'm coming. I just wanted to suggest that we deal with the matter next week,
okay,
after they have also met and clarified,
okay,
some of the, all right, the terminology.
Okay. Thanks. Shall we then move on to page 6? Huh? Haven't we dealt with page 5? Okay, at the upper slide on page 5, we touched on that one. All right, slide 10 on page 5. Anything, any clarity seeking question? None. Page 6, top slide, the bottom slide. Honourable Member Killian.
Chairperson, first of all, I think the proposal by the department is welcomed. It is just interesting that to a certain extent, there were not only in this
provision, but in others, well, obviously this is not the definition. But in some of the other clauses, there was an omission of the private university sector. And it would be interesting to understand, was that a deliberate attempt initially, or was it simply an oversight, and was there a decision that it is important to cover everything in the Higher Education Act? If we could just have an explanation.
Okay. The department?
Yeah, it was oversight. The bill has been, the act has been drafted with a chapter identifying the impact on your private institution. And in the drafting process, focus of the private were focusing on that chapter. But the cross-cutting issues were not fully appreciated, and we've identified some concerns, and that is for oversight, and it comes to the level.
Okay, thank you. Shall we then move on to the next page? Okay. Slide. Which page are you?
Page 6 and 7.
Okay. Let's start with page 6, and then we'll move to page 7.
Okay, well, what you've done here, as a proposal, is explain to us why you need things like university college, a definition of university college or higher education college, which everyone understands. It sounds like good reasoning. But I think the point being made by UCT or USAC, I can't remember which one, was not so much that. It was why suddenly in the Act do you make these definitional points when in fact that's normally been it hasn't been in the Act. You haven't got substantial definitional arguments in the Act. And this seemed to be an anomaly, so I just want to hit on that.
Thank you, Professor. Department?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think if we look at this particular presentation, it is around changed circumstances that has brought about the need for this particular amendment. The changed circumstances were when we established the University of Limpopo and Mpumalanga and the Salt Lake University, and even to some extent the Mahato. The issue is we up to that point before the establishment we could live with the Higher Education Act because it did not have a comparator for the private institutions in terms of Section 29 of the Constitution. So we could very easily, prior to that, have said, these are our 21 universities, that's how they are, they perform all the functions, research, development, postgraduate, etc. Therefore, the privates were not allowed because there was no comparator. The problem came about is when we have established now Soplaki and Malanga, in the way that it is articulated now in terms of the field approach, 500 students or 600 students, means that we would have a constitutional challenge by all the privates, whether they're having 100 students to be called a university. And that's the reason that we have to then define it. And in any case, college is in the current act, the principal act. College is there, the definition has just been split into university college and a higher education college. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a follow-up question?
Quick one. Is TVS College then not a definitional type of college? If you're going to start defining all these colleges, don't you need to include that as a third definition?
Jefferson, the TVS College is defined in the Continuing Education and Training Act, so it's not in this legislation to be defined in that particular legislation. If I understand the question. These are only colleges that offer level 5 qualifications and above on the HEQSF.
Okay. So there's a new category, if I understand you correctly. You have your TVET colleges. Now you're introducing those colleges that are still at a developmental stage. Then you call those university colleges until they develop to a full-blown university, a full-fledged university, am I correct? So it differentiates the different stages. Okay, so that's fine. Is it another follow-up? And then Honourable Member Mbata and then Honourable Member Killian.
Chair, now we're going to have three kinds of college. I don't think this has ever been discussed on a policy level, that we're going to suddenly have three types of college. People, in my view, won't know what you're talking about. They won't know the differences between them. And it seems to me, and I think that's what Yusuf was saying, a sort of ad hoc adding in of definitions of things because you had a problem, without it being broadly considered in terms of the entire higher education system and its structures. And it certainly doesn't appear in the white paper. It just has a sort of ad hoc feel about the whole thing, and a retroactive thing. You know, we had a problem, now let's quickly have a definition now to solve that problem. So I think what they're saying, and I think I agree with them, it hasn't really been thought through in the broader sense of the structure of the higher education system as a whole, and suddenly new kind of colleges added. Thank you.
No, it's not entirely the case. I think if honorable members were paying attention, in his opening remarks, the minister indicated that this is not the totality of how we see the system evolving and being structured. We are working on the development of the national plan for post-school, which would be concluded by March 2017, upon which we would have to undertake a comprehensive review of all pieces of legislation that define the post-school education and training, of which at the present moment they are a bit separate and pocketed. But this intervention is so far in relation to Higher Education Act and informed by the experiences as we are getting along at the present moment. Partly you are correct, but that's where we are going to. We are not there as yet. So that hasn't escaped our minds and our notice.
Yeah, Chair, I agree with what the teacher is saying. Maybe just a small addition. University college is not new, though, Honorable Kozoli. It's an old concept, which we aren't changing, and we know what we mean. Because, for instance, what the teacher is saying in terms of experience, it's not only just a legal challenge that is likely to be a problem if we don't have this definition. We also think we should not have just given those universities full status right away. That was another risk, you know, because you can't just give them something new that just acts like a fully fledged university. They are possibly the first universities to perform like that in South Africa. Historically, all universities started as university colleges falling under other more established institutions. So the risk was not only legal, also the risk was just sustainability. So, and as I say, that's not a new thing. You are right also, as the teacher is saying, that higher education college may be something new, but also given our experiences now, as a matter of fact, that's a step towards maybe the comprehensive discussion that we're talking about. Because we also want to move towards having a comprehensive and interlinked college system in South Africa. We don't quite have that at the moment. And also, as we were saying, you know, catering for other, there are many other kinds of colleges. And they don't as yet neatly talk to each other. Just in the public sector, you have a justice college, you have a police college, you have nursing colleges, you have agricultural colleges. One of the tasks we want to set for ourselves as this department is to actually define that. But there is an immediate gap which makes us to say it's to higher education college. So then the choice we have is that we can't then say, because we've not fully taken into account everything, then we can't do this, because if we don't do it, we are actually leaving a gap in the system that is also not helping us. This is the last point also. The other challenge that we are dealing with, is actually a level 5. That really is one of our big headaches. For example, we've got, I'm told, 50 higher education certificates or higher certificates. But we are only having very few, in fact, that we are. And we want to expand that because there is a very big need to actually respond to a whole range of imperatives, whether it's foundation-type programs and a whole range of issues. Once we understand Professor Pozzoli's concerns and the other concerns expressed by the other ideas, but I don't think this is a train set. Because if we don't do it, then we leave this gap. You know, you have got institutions that are sitting undefined and so on. So our plea would be that let's give this a chance. Why is not really not that, as the DG is saying, we are developing a plan that we want to finalize by early next year. Thank you.
I think one submission alluded to, or they asked a question whether the department has a policy, or a department is going to develop a policy in this regard. I don't know if that's already been responded.
No, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, again, within the context of the principal legislation, if you look at the powers given to the minister in the current legislation, section 21, it says the minister may, after consulting CHE, declare an education institution providing higher education as university, technicon, or college. Now, if you look at the current definitions, the minister is obliged before the minister, because those two types are not being established, university college, nor higher education college. The minister is obliged, in terms of looking at the definition, in terms of section 3.3, to determine policy, the institutional type, the consultation, etc., with all the stakeholders, etc. So currently we don't have those two, but minister will have to do it under policy, which in the current legislation was not the case.
Okay. We are on page 6, page 7. Professor, I know you wanted to write on. Okay, it's already okay. Page 8. Professor Pozzoli, Honorable Member Killian.
Page 8 brings us back again to unfair, discriminatory versus wrongful, and has failed to comply with any law the university could receive a directive. Now, that could mean that if the university toilets are not clean, according to the law about clean toilets, the minister could intervene. You see, it's all very well arguing in response to my arguments that common sense tells you that no minister would ever do that. But that's not a way to make law. A way to make law is to not have silly provisions like that in it, but to cut down the provisions so that it isn't any law. And I don't understand why UCT's recommendation has been rejected, which is that it becomes a substantial contravention of or failure to comply with any law. So that eliminates the toilets not being clean possibility. A substantial contravention of or failure to provide any law. And can I also say that I'm really not happy with the response on clause 42. For Mr. Kakana to say, Honourable Kakana to say, well, you know, the constitution is there, that can back us up, and if the minister dares to do this, you can go to the court and stop him. That also to me speaks about how you don't draw up laws. You don't draw up law knowing that there's a very strong possibility that it will lead to the Constitution having to be invoked. The law surely should make that very unlikely. The law should be so well drawn up that going having to go to the Constitutional Court is not a likely possibility. And in fact, that's one of the things that I would think would make the law unconstitutional. If contained in it is a clause where we can all see that people might go to the Constitutional Court because of its abuse. Which is the one saying, well, you know, wrongful conduct, fails to comply with law, minister can issue directive and that directive can be put. Thank you.
To the department, Honourable Minister.
I have a sense of deja vu back in the early 90s at the Cortes negotiations in the Constitutional Assembly, Professor Pozzoli, because the part of this thing at the heart of trying to balance autonomy and public accountability. Because what also concerns me with your argument is that you're really trying to say government must really be minimalist. You know, what is substantial? Because there's an issue there. How substantial is substantial? Because it's the old debate, in fact, that we had when we were even drafting the Constitution and when we were passing the Higher Education Act in 1997, that there is always this thing of trying to push government to have less and less power to act. What is wrong to say has failed to comply with any law? And it's failure to comply with the law. You know, there is a test. Why should it only apply if it's a substantial contravention? How substantial is it? Does it mean that if it's not substantial, it's not contravention of the law? That is the issue that I have, Chairperson. I don't know why any university should be afraid of being charged of failing to comply with the law. And why should we be... Why is it constitutional to say substantial, but failure to comply with any law being seen as being unconstitutional? And I don't want us to enter into a circus theoretical debate, but I think we should go back to even what Honorable Mbatha was saying earlier about the fact that we can't be drafting a law thinking about all the time administrative aspects and issues of this. I'm not saying that we must be careless and not consider that, but all the time, you know, how do you implement this? You fail to comply with the law, any law. So the issue can be taken. I have a problem with this substantial contravention, actually, because that itself is a subject of debate. Censure.
Is it a follow-up?
Yes.
Okay. Follow-up?
All right. Chair, the University of Fort Hare just took, from what one understands, some of the NSFAS funding that has been given and put it into university salaries. Okay. I would assume that that's a contravention of the law. And this law now means that the minister could immediately issue a directive and that director could immediately put that university under administration. And to me, that seems extreme. So it's not whether or not you comply with the law. Of course you must comply with the law. Nobody's saying, no, you must be let off for not complying with the law. It's about when is the minister allowed to intervene that is the issue, not whether or not you comply with the law. And the minister's intervention has now been pushed back to the point where if the toilets were not clean, he could intervene and put the university under administration, to give an extreme example. So that is what the law will say if we pass it in this form. And you could all very well shake your head and say, no, we would never do that, but the law would provide for that. Thank you.
Honourable Minister, I see Professor Tipe, the drafter of the amendment, will want to come in.
Yeah, that's very good. Honourable Pozzoli, to issue a directive does not mean putting an institution under administration. You argue as if, in fact, one of the things that has been a concern to us is that the law, as it stands now, has not allowed its prior step even to appointing an assessor. All the time, precisely we're trying to run away that when our problems that we see as small, we issue a directive to the council, please investigate this or please address this. That's what this is meant for, and it does not mean that you are therefore going to put an institution under administration just because it's got dirty toilets. In fact, it does exactly what you are concerned about, that we are able that things that do not require a hammer in order to hit a fly, we are able to make provision for that. That's what the intention of a directive. And also, it really does not mean that one would be so petty
as to the kinds of things. But otherwise, I have to be careful for that. What is substantial then that you can give me as an example, you know? So that's I thought I must clarify the aspect about issuing a directive or violation of the law and taking action does not equal administration.
Professor Didier?
Honorable Chair, I think the minister covers the 80% with his response. I think we should not forget what was said earlier on by the legal advisor to this committee. If you look at the current arrangement in 49A, intervention by a minister, it says that the minister may issue a directive and then there's a list of things there. And it says, is involved, is unable, etc. That puts the minister in a very difficult situation because at the moment of issuing the directive, the minister could be asked to say, prove now, is this institution involved in financial impropriety? Is it unable to perform its functions? That's what current legislation is saying. The new one says, no, we don't ask the minister to prove that or to substantiate that at the time of issuing the directive because we're not... the old dispensation would mean that the minister has now made a judgment that this is the case. Now, the proposal is that he may issue the directive if he has reasonable grounds to believe, not to say that it is so, to believe that certain things are happening. And that's an engagement with the Council of the University at a totally different level than what was anticipated previously. And what's also important here, Honourable Chair, is the fact that the Minister had no choice in terms of the current legislation, that if he is not satisfied with the response of the institution to his directives, the Act now says he must dissolve the Council and put the institution under administration. That's what the current legislation is saying. Now, the minister has at least three options to deal with it in three different ways. To say that, you know, the minister may appoint an independent assessor. That's not administration. The minister may take any other step. That's not administration. But if it becomes clear through the process that indeed this institution is involved in financial impropriety, then the minister also has the option to put the institution under administration. But it's a much different approach that is now adopted in the proposal to what it was.
Thank you very much. Well, to be honest, I'm very happy with the way things are happening now, but time is against us. I wish we had more time. It was to me more meaningful for the men and women are doing it now. So, shall we then, whoever is being asked, can please be short to the point, giving our responses, short and to the point, just give the actual, you know, so that we can then make progress. We have about 30 pages here, okay, maybe, and they're still on 5. So I'm afraid I'm going to change the approach and then ask the members to. Okay, we are on page 8. I'm sorry, I'm on page 8. And then, okay. All right, shall we then have another clarity-seeking question? Any clarity-seeking question? On page 8? Come again. All right, let's move on to page. All right, let's move to page 9. Page 10. Page 11. All All right, on page 10, I would like to get clarity on, for instance, your very last sentence on slide number 22, which says, apply private higher education institutions subject to the necessary changes. Necessary changes. What changes are you anticipating here? Huh? Well, I'm on page 11. There was no question on page 10, so I moved to page 11.
Chair, may I give an example?
Yes.
Public higher education institutions have senates.
Okay.
But private higher education institutions may not have a senate. And I think the Act refers specifically to the position of the senate of the university. So that would be a change required by the context.
Okay.
But if you then refer to private higher education institutions, you would replace the word senate with whatever equivalent governance structure or policy making structure they have in place.
Okay. Are we on page 11? Honourable Member Killian, Honourable Member Mbatha.
Thank you, Chairperson. But the fact is here that this provision is now also extended again to the private institutions, which was not in the Amendment Act originally. So it is therefore a proposed adjustment, proposed amendment that is foreseen here to insert another subsection. Thank you. I just wanted to ask that.
I remember about that.
Yeah. On slide 21, page 11.
Yes. Slide 21.
I just want to double check the impressions of the department on the two scenarios. It would have been, this is my take, it would have been better for a country like ours, which is in the earlier phases of its regulation, to even enforce or articulate a preferred like mind character for higher education institution and the picture that definitely propels it. To even effect those features to private entities. Because the examples and the history that we deal with here, it shows that if we don't do that, then we're leaving that kind of system, not defined, but also in all sorts of, foreign definitions. My take is that the law, in its composition, must have a feature of public good, meaning inherent assumption is that whatever operates within the sector must be of public good. Now, public good does not define only the provision at public service level. It also defines the provision of same activities at private entities. I would have appreciated that we really, really enforce that higher education private sector also has seen it. Because then, coherently, it would have been better to know what defines us as a whole. Because this is a moving train. Everybody comes in here, and Honorable Zimande will tell you, when private higher education started, in particular by gullible individuals, it was very dangerous to even define exactly the type of even syllabus that they were on. So in protection of our young citizens, it is important that we characterize private higher education provision in the same way as public. Honorable Zimande, you will remember, it was only the progressive movement like Higher College and many others that was able at least to look in similar. The other individuals were gullible. At some point, there were two people defining what you call a private higher education institution. What is that?
Thank you very much. It's a comment, am I right? And a proposal combined. Yes. That's how I picked it up. No, it's remember, this bill is ours now. You influence us, not them. The bill is ours now. Okay, no, that's fine. Thank you very much. Shall we then move on to, you've responded, am I right? Yeah, changes, okay. Shall we move on to page 12? I don't see anything there. page 13, page 14, page 15, page 16. Honourable Member Chilian.
Chairperson, I know that we are now correcting the reference to the BFMA, but I just want to say that I don't think we can any longer postpone, and I know it has to be, well, it has to go through the legislature.
Which slide, 31?
It's slide 32, okay, with reference to Article 239 of the Constitution,
okay. Chairperson,
because that includes all institutions of higher learning, public institutions, under Section 239 of the Constitution. And I think it's just important for us to realize that, because if we look at the rest of the Act, that the minister demands public accountability from institutions about money that is voted through Treasury, and that's the whole Chapter 13, Chairperson, which is money appropriated in the bill, etc., and the Auditor General to follow up, I don't think we can, in fact, allow the sector to not be included in the PSMA provision. So all I'm saying is we will have to take the necessary action to also make sure that public higher education is brought into the PSMA. Thank you, Chair.
If I understood you correctly, in future, not in this amendment, because it should then have no relevance with the public PSMA as it stands now. Okay. No, that's fine. All right, Professor
Pozzoli? Just to signal that I don't agree with that proposal. So that if it was to come to this committee, we would have an massive disagreement.
Remember, it's in future. Can't even discuss it. This is a future thing, you know? Future discussion. We're not going to preempt the future discussion debate on this matter. Is it a follow-up or for the clarity?
For the clarity. Just listen to the Constitution. Now, I know my learned friend to the left always claims that they are protecting the Constitution. Similarly, the DA claims to be the guardians of the Constitution. But the Constitution says, unless the context indicates otherwise, an organ of state means A, any department of state or administration, etc., etc., B, any other functionary or institution exercising a power or performing a function in terms of the constitution or the provincial constitution, or three, exercising a public power or performing a public function in terms of any legislation. Now clearly, there is a severe disjuncture between the constitution and the BFMA, and this is where public higher education is falling through the cracks. We are passing the appropriation bill annually in terms of Chapter 13 of the Constitution. And we must follow the money. The money must be utilized for the purposes it is intended to be utilized for. I cannot think in my wildest of dreams that the Democratic Alliance can be...
Are we discussing this now? Because I'm very happy to reply that you said you're not going to discuss it.
Of course, we are on clarity seeking. So I see, hey, honorable member, I'm telling you, hey, you know. Yeah, but that's fine. I said this information is not lost. We will use it in the future. But for now, universities cannot be regulated by the PFMA, because in the definitions of institutions covered by the PFMA, the universities are not included there. So it means in future, actually through this exercise, we have identified a gap in the PFMA, but that's not our baby. The baby of the Department of Finance, if they want to amend, they can then start amending. And it's not going to apply to us now. So we can't stop, block ourselves because of the legislation that is not there yet. Maybe at the right time, we can then come back to it. But for now, we are not covered. What I can agree with is that any law must be consistent with the Constitution. So we've identified a gap. So they say after some time when you identify gaps, you review. So we know that. Let's discuss the PFMA, please.
Yes.
We don't have time.
I just want to rectify the idea that the entire university sector is unconstitutional in its financial arrangements. This is an absolute lie. It's not. It's perfectly constitutional. The minister would have made sure it conformed to the Constitution if it wasn't. So I think that this should not be allowed to stand as an accusation against universities that their financial management is unconstitutional. It's perfectly well regulated through the Higher Education Act, and it's inaccurate to say that university finances are
really trying to debate, and I know we all get paid for debating. The committees are also in the house, but for now, we are on clarity.
It was not much.
Please determine it.
But I did not say that the universities
see,
are
listen unconstitu- to me, we will not end up agreeing, no, but, you know, amongst ourselves.
So please listen to me.
Can I guide this meeting?
Yeah. I just made the point that there was
can
a
Can I guide the meeting? Thank you very much. All right, so we are page 16. Honourable Member Mbata.
I'm still on page. I might be a little bit behind.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just trying to check maybe what is the impressions of the department. What will it take to get the universities in line with what my colleague here is talking about, Honorable Philip? Why do we delay and postpone? What do we need to recommend saying to the Department of National Finance? Because for me, to the best of my ability, it's long overdue. But is your case? Why are we still stopping go and stopping go?
Okay, advocate.
Chair, the Constitution provides three possibilities when it comes to legislation. The one is for where the powers are within the national competency only. There is a specific process, specific requirements. There is one where there is a concurrent function and there is a different approach to that. And then the third stream is that of monetary legislation. And that legislation is specifically identified with a specific process attached to the fundamental of the functional authority of the Minister of Finance. And it's only the Minister of Finance that can make amendments to the PFMA. The PFMA is not only need to be amended in order to list them as public entities, but there is a specific provision to exclude universities from the PFMA. And that substantive provision must be amended, and the only authority who can amend it is through the process of, I think it's Section 77 of the Constitution, which will then provide the outcome that is required.
Thank you. So we are satisfied. Shall we move on to 15, we had already passed, and then 16? Any clarity-seeking question? Okay, this is also a clarity-seeking question from me. What happens in case the minister ignores the adverse findings? I don't know if I've pronounced this correctly. Of the independent assessor against a council member. Must remember, we don't need to talk about this one. We all agree. But there's this thing called future, which is long. And then you might get other people who, you know. What happens in this case? A prof?
Well, Chair, the current legislation actually says that if an adverse finding is made against an individual, that person is banned from sitting on a council of a public institution forever. Now, what we're saying now is that if such a decision is made, an adverse finding against an individual who was a member of the council, when a university was, say, put under administration, that person could then ask for a revision of that finding by the minister. And in that process, I think what we put in the act, in the bill, is to make sure that there's full compliance with FIRE. which is important. And I do not have an answer if the minister is not trusted, or a minister is not trusted for that decision. Then I do not have an answer to the honourable members. But that was the only mechanism that we could find that should not be costly for the individual, because if you don't allow it to happen against the backdrop of compliance with PAYA to be done by the minister, then you have to approach another body, a court of law or another body, and the cost associated with that may just make it problematic for the person that's been implicated. But there's another aspect to this, and that is that in terms of the new bill, the procedure to be followed by an independent assessor is now much more and much closer monitored, again, through the basic principles of PAYA. So that finding will also be based on a much more a process that's much more acceptable in terms of basic constitutional principles.
Okay, Honourable Member Mthunu, Honourable Professor Pozori, and then Honourable Member Ketana, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. On slide 34, I would like to know why is the department limiting the revocation or withdrawal of the qualification to 2 years. Is the department condoning that an attorney, for instance, can continue to practice with a qualification, with a qualification obtained erroneously, if the university could not detect within a period of 2 years? Thank you. The other one of not applying to private institutions being covered on your slide 35. Thank you.
All right. Honourable Member Professor Pozoli.
Chair, the Minister got very cross because we said that this extended his powers and that it was a grant for power by the Minister. However, here is yet another example of the Minister setting himself up, or being set up by the law, as a court. He is now going to have the discretion to say, well, you know, the administrator said you were a crook, come and appeal and I'll decide you weren't a crook, basically. That's what this law says. And while again, with a good minister like we have, this would never happen, but should a completely unscrupulous minister get into thing, which the law would meant to protect us against, he would then be able to just declare, you know, somebody who he liked or someone who was in his patronage network as not a criminal and not having forged his document and not having stolen money, which are all things that we know happen in these universities under administration. And I think that, again, we see this as an unwarranted extension of the powers of the minister or ministerial powers, and we will be opposing it. Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Member Ketana. Prof, you must remember to turn the light there.
Yes. Chair, I do want to go into the debate, but I personally was saying that I think there are enough checks and balances. What Professor Pozoli said, we can have an act that actually is setting us up to be taking all matters to court. The act merely says that it is enough on its own and we can as much avoid going to court as far. I agree with that, but I was saying this act is existing under circumstances where there are separation of powers, there are checks and balances, like the accessor, the legal advisor says, the accessor will always be sent as part of checks and balances when the minister gives a directive. Now the point is, if we're arguing that we're preparing for a future, you quoted an example of an EFF minister, I mean, that is far-fetched. You have to change the constitution first there before you can change the act. So if you prepare an act such that the future is prepared, but that future is so far-fetched, that is so fundamental that you have to change, I mean, then EFF minister can never operate under the existing constitution. So I'm just saying, let's accept what is actually practical. And what is practical is that there are enough checks and balances. And that for us we can live with. Otherwise, if you prefer the future that is so far-fetched that you have to start the constitution, I mean, that's a very big thing for you to do.
Thanks, Honourable Member Ketan. I see Ms. Vuyo. So, may I request that members accede to my earlier call that we rise above political party lines. Just for this exercise, you know. But lawmaking cannot be politicized. Okay, thank you very much.
Chairperson, I would like to through you to make a comment in respect of the new edition on this provision. What I would like to say is, if we look into one of the main objectives of effecting this amendment is to ensure that the prior and the father are also part of this bill, which means to make sure that the bill, the act, the existing act is aligned with the prior and the father. That's the first thing. Therefore, in respect of this provision, what it means for me is, first of all, I think everybody is understands that if, an example, this adverse finding is made and referred to the minister, the minister cannot just wrap a stamp that's the decision that's made, the findings, let's put it like that, by the assessor. Obviously, the minister will have to apply his mind or her mind on the findings, that's point number one. And the other issue would be, in applying the findings, in order to apply a PADRA, you have to give the person whom the adverse finding is made against an opportunity to make representations. So in that instance, the minister will still have to apply his mind and say, oh yes, this is really an adverse, and in light of the information that I have, then make a decision in respect to that. Of course, it's up to the committee to say, is that enough, then if you have a different minister, is that enough if you have a minister who's corrupt or whatever is going on, so that's a separate issue altogether. But my point is the effect of this, of what is included now, is to make sure that PADRA is covered, that's number one, and secondly, to ensure that the minister is not a rubber stamper. So the other finding, therefore, you cannot serve in the panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Shall we move on to page 17? 18? Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. Ms. Mkunu, yeah, rose on a certain point that needs clarification by the department. It's on, yeah, page 17 on, slide number 34.
Chair, the issue of the two-year prescription is not that it, the university must wait for 2 years. It is just that there is a period, a window period of 2 years within which the power to revocate is given. And that means that if that, whenever it is detected that there is a problem, erroneously, there is a responsibility on the university to take action. That it might be that they don't pick up that, that problem immediately, but it can't be left forever. And that the period of prescription is normally to provide a legal certainty that things go on. You acknowledge things went wrong, but in that period of time, you can correct, but after you live with it. And this is the same approach. So if a person got the qualification due to no fault of his own, because he was not aware. It was a problem caused by the administration of the university. It's their problem, their mistake they made. Then a period of 2 years is given for that institution to correct it and to take it back and then allow the process to go on. And if that happened 30 years ago, the same qualification, the content of the qualification might be substantially changed. It be not possible to actually provide additional training or courses in order to comply with the requirements of all those things. So that is the thought behind it. If there's an approach that has been taken and which also came from the universities, and I would like also Professor De Beer, because it's an issue that he specifically introduced in the drafting of the bill, where the concept of dealing with your erroneous awarding of qualifications totally different from your fraudulent, because there is fault that is specifically contributed to the individual, and there is no excuse that individuals should not get the benefit of his poisonous and illegal action.
Professor Tibia comes in. The minister earlier on asked to excuse himself, and the minister is excused for whatever explanation by the minister that has been dedicated to the DG. Honorable member Mata agreed. Agreed. Okay, then. Okay. May we then proceed, Prof?
Chair, briefly, you cannot punish a student forever for mistakes made by a university administratively. That's why you have to have the 2-year maximum. And secondly, the question was actually in terms of the professional status of such an individual. The example was, can this person now practice as an attorney in the meantime? The fact that you've received a degree from the university does not change whatever requirement is set by a professional body for access to that particular profession. They still have to apply their own rules.
Chair, the kind of case that is envisaged here is a little bit beyond me. I mean, I've worked in a university for a long time, and I don't think I've ever... It seems to be a huge sledgehammer to poke with a very small little insect. I mean, how often does this happen? And is there a huge problem of people having degrees because there was a mistake made by the university, which then are removed? I'm not sure whether this is a common enough problem for us to warrant putting it in the law. Thank you.
From where I'm sitting, prevention is better than cure. People will be scared to do it because they know that there will be consequences. Or they'll be careful because knowing that there will be consequences. Not there to regulate, to address particular situations, to regulate in general. Okay, Prof? Zakat. All right. Okay then. Should we then move to page 18? Page 19. Page 20. Ms. Killian.
So again, at slide 40, Chairperson, the department is proposing that it be extended to the private institutions at the bottom of the slide.
Okay. Okay. But then on slide number 39, clause 3, the department has noted this concern. However, it submits that this concern will be adequately clarified by the policy to be determined by the minister. I think you have earlier on responded to the powers of the minister to determine policy. Okay, no, then it's fine. Then we'll cover it. All right, any response to Honourable Member Keegan's clarification question?
Yeah, as stated earlier on, when it comes to the issue of your qualifications, it is important that it is cross-cutting and your the current provision is only addressing public institutions. And what we are proposing that the committee consider that the same provision must also be made applicable to the private institutions. As I've indicated, the private institutions are covered within a specific chapter, and that we include it in that chapter. By reference, we will then make it mutatis mutandis with the necessary application then also applicable to the private institutions.
in order to address the system as a whole.
Any follow-up question, Honorable? Okay, happy. Shall we move on to page 21? I know that there was a proposal. Remember, these are students now. There was a proposal for inclusion of racial equality. Can you elaborate on your response to this? Racial equality.
Yeah, the response, as you are saying, is that the issue of racial equality is already addressed in other legislation, and which is also applicable to our education system. It will also be picked up when the discussion about transformation and the policy determined by that comes into play. We've got the act that we refer to, the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, is an act that actually flew out of the Constitution itself. It was a requirement of the Constitution, and it got the so-called constitutional status, like PAJA and PAIA. The importance of it is how you apply it in the system, not the establishing the framework within what is the concept of racial discrimination, but it is how you apply it in the system. And that is, in the view of the department, appropriate that it is dealt with within the transformation goals and the oversight mechanisms in order to ensure the current legislation will also be covered and properly implemented with the necessary focus to it.
Member Mbakete, follow up? Okay.
I just want to check the idea situation that maybe the department may wish to consider. Given our history, in circumstances like the ones that are raised here and the ones that are currently happening, I know the act is not always, you know, supposed to be specific on some of these matters. I just want to check. If we were not to include any enforceable suggestions here, what is it that could be an assurance? I come from a background of if there were sources of agreement that the Constitution of 1996 was protective enough to everybody, then many incidences in South Africa would have never or whenever even supposed to have happened, including these ones. I'm just trying to ascertain that if somebody suggests something like this and you say we're not putting a cold water on the idea, but we're saying the systems internal will be beefed up to advise universities to be much more vigilant and have instruments that does not only detect but also protect and vigilantly holds those who actually violate the rights of others. Now, I'm the campaigner of the act to have anything like that, but I'm saying we have a generation of young people that mustn't suffer what we did. And the yesterday and the Monday activities elsewhere shows that we are moving the opposite end. Now, if I were to assure anyone, what would you suggest? Let's say we don't want to negotiate legislating everything. Given 20 years and the stage of what universities are today, what do you think we must do now? It must not be legalized in a form of not legalized as a term, but it mustn't be banned specifically by an act. Because the Constitution has done that, but it's not enough.
Okay, Honorable Member Mbata, thanks, you've made your point. The department can respond.
Thank you, sir. I think the legal services would respond to the pertinent issues that relate to law.
But I think perhaps what we also have to consider, in human life, there are things that would relate to human behavior. And I don't think you would be able to legislate just every bit and piece of how a person should behave for what have you, and put that into legislation. Of course, there should be context within which certain conduct should actually happen. But also, without being in defense of the universities and the activities that are actually taking, you know, place there. I mean, if you look at times, you would find the members of parliament, you know, just... But I don't know whether the honorable members do actually look at this piece. If they extended out there to other sectors of society, how would they turn out to be? So my appeal is that let's look at the legislation and locate it within the context of what is the reflective of society at the present moment. But if we're going to pigeonhole a university and the perhaps the expectation would be it should be a distinct figure of its own, not be a reflective as a microcosm of society. I think perhaps would be really missing the point. But we need to look at these matters genuinely and seek to address them so that they are able to uphold the values we want to see, as the numbers are suggesting. But the legal team would be respond to specific legal matters.
Chair, what the EG says is absolutely 100% correct. The approach is also to create a space for the system to develop measures and oversight procedures in order to deal with it. As to the implementation of these concepts of discrimination, racial discrimination, we've got already legislation, and that quote is the legislation, the Probation of Equity and Provision of Fair and Fair Discrimination Act, which actually also criminalizes the using of specific words which is race related. And the court applied it vigorously, huge consequences are attached to that. But that's the final outcome. The problem is, in many cases, there is things that are happening, and the urgency or the implementation of the current legislation is not followed through. And drafting of legislation cannot deal with that. It is also, it won't help to have three pieces of legislation dealing with the same issue, but each one got a slightly different approach, and therefore in the end it creates loopholes because the one is different from the other. The department is of the opinion that the criminalization of this type of behavior is already provided for in the legislation. It is legislation that is sanctioned by the constitutional principle, and because this constitutional status to that legislation, and that it is therefore of a much better effectiveness in law than it would have had by just providing a criminal offence related with our substance, like we've got in that piece of legislation.
Thank you very much. I don't answer to the labor, the better. I think we at least we now have some deeper insight on the matters that were explained by both the DG and Professor G. Shall we then move on to item number, to page 21. Okay, page 21, I don't know, maybe I'll also explore my rigidity. I worked in the administration from 1981. The word instruction was not heavy. We were even taught, you know, you take instructions and carry them out, and if you've got issues during the time, those times, man, you can discuss them later. That's how we brought up. Yes, you know, very rigid. But I have no regret for him. We learned this. Now, why do directive instruction? I have a problem with us wanting to be soft on these things, because if we're soft, we're not going to get things to happen. Instructions are instructions. Why are we not happy with the word instruction? We want directive. You know? Okay, Prof?
The word is used, if you think of the start of the process, as I've explained earlier, where the minister may have reasonable grounds to believe something, and how he would like that to be attended to by the council of the university. That's a request. That's not an instruction.
Oh, okay.
So I think one would take that important dimension out of the process if you justify it as the instruction from the outset. Apart from the shock wave that it would send out into the system, if you do that.
But this amendment is an intervention, which means some directives have not been taken seriously in the past. So now we want to come in and give instruction. No, that's fine.
What I would like to add is, I'm trying to put this as first of all, in the sense of the drafting language, there are certain words that you use for drafting proposals. That's number one. And secondly, when you talk about the directive, you're basically saying, you must follow this step to do A, B, C, but at the end of the day, do what the minister requires you to do. So I think the difference would be it's a legal terminology in the representation.
My understanding is that this wording of instruction in the Stellenbosch Transformation Stellenbosch media presentation, because in the proposal, in the bill, you had directive. But when the Transformation Stellenbosch media presentation, they favored instruction rather than directive. And then to do the public hearing. And I think one of the members said to them, don't you think that directive is even better than instruction? And I thought they understood it. The way they read it, they understood, and I think they were convinced that directive is actually better than instruction. So maybe it has to get a clarity now as to what those who now made some changes here, they also favor instruction rather than directive. I think that's a point that we need to.
Page 23. Honourable members, if you look at page 24 to page 29, all these issues have been responded to. Please look at them. So then I want to propose that we then skip them and go straight to page. All these issues, those who made submissions, they repeated, and those have already been responded to. So shall we move on to page 30 if you all agree? Agreed? Mr. Mata? Agreed. Professor? Agreed? Agreed. All right, shall we then move on to page 30? Any clarity seeking question on page 30? Thank Okay. Honourable Member Killian.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, on slide 59, section 3 sub 3 C is being addressed, and there's a proposal from the department. Now, I just have a little bit of a concern. I maybe they can just explain to us. It now appears, whereas we have earlier discussed the whole issue of higher education, and this is being the Higher Education Amendment Bill, and that the college sector, the TVET sector, must still be addressed, etc., etc. Now we bring in, or this is the proposed expansion, to also include across the education and training system. Now, can the department please clarify, because this now makes it wider from where I sit than the higher education system. Can we just please give an explanation why this is, in fact, suggested to the committee? Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Pacheco?
Thank you, Chairperson. If you remember in the oral submissions, the issue was brought about that articulation is not within the posts, because this is post-school education and training system. The articulation actually is from other subsystems to the post-school system itself. And the minister does have that mandate in terms of the NQF Act. So that is what the department is putting in for your consideration. If it's just a post-school education and training system, it's also fine. But then it means we only deal with one institution against the other in the post-school. We don't look at the 12s coming into the post-school system. So that's just a suggestion to the committee. The department did feel that there's a point in restricting articulation and recognition of prior learning. The minister also... it's fine. Let me stop there. I think I've answered the question of school versus the post-school.
Okay. Any other input or top up? All right. No, that's fine. Now, on your slide number 60, the part that talks about declaration of university reserves, what's your take? Declaration of university reserves? I'm being advised that it's not in the bill, but it falls under investment, okay. Because that's where reserves are being used, you know. They're taken and invested, and then the general outcry out there, remember I represent the society, these must be allocated to students instead of the reserves being invested.
I forget to respond to this. But I think the impression that universities have got huge money sitting out there doing nothing is actually incorrect.
Okay.
I don't think we need to perpetuate this. Our institutions are really struggling. And that's a matter that we are working very hard, you know, to address as government. And in some instances, even if there are some bit of reserves, it's other ones off. It's not a recurring resource that will always be there. So at the point of using it, it's gone. And you have to square one.
Okay. That's fine. I think the explanation suffices. But also this is outside the scope of the bill. Just wanted to link it to the investment. We're now on 31. Yes.
There was a document submitted to us by the Higher Education Transformation Network which alleged that it had figures of the levels of reserves in universities. Could we hear from the DG what he seems to be suggesting is that document was incorrect?
and I would just like him to confirm that that is the case.
No, I won't speak, you know, into that. Right? I'm talking in respect to our established engagement and daily operations with the institution and what we continue to discover as we engage and get into deeper with respect to implementation of certain programs of intervention by the department. So I was just cautioning the portfolio committee that not everything we should just take at face value, that it is the absolute truth that there are huge money that universities are having. It's not the case in fact, but I won't get into the specifics in respect to what was tabled to you. Of course, they would have to substantiate that and the methodology that they have actually used. What I know is that some institutions, if you look at their liability and what is in their books, it's a very much huge concern where the liabilities far outstrip the resources that some of these institutions are having. But to look at the total picture of what it is in respect to the institution as a whole and its operations, including liabilities thereof, and you could be able to make that determination.
Okay, no, thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up question, Prof? Honourable Member Mbata.
I just want to say this in person. I mean, with respect to what the DG is saying, I think we should not be made not to understand that there are universities with results. There are. And maybe what the presenters were intending to do, they were intending to plead for a case of what could propel a better solution for public use or for public sharing of those resources. And their case in particular, in pleading it, they were indicating that some of these reserves were not by accident or by sheer grace of God. They had historical benefits of racial nature, and the accumulation was as such that they need to at least be shared in the current environment. And in my book, it was supposed to have happened as way as 19 years ago, if it were a genuine case of wanting to transform higher education, but there was never any intention there. But I'm not there now, but I'm saying it is the truth. I think the DG mustn't speak here like a priest. You know the truth. There are universities with exceptional reserves, and they will even protect them. They will even go to an extent of hiding them from you. We know that. I'm just speaking as a counselor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think what the bill tries to do is to list the financial instruments and those financial mechanisms that are subject to statutory requirements
in regards to where investment should be made. So, for example, one cannot invest in the bakery of an entrepreneur around the corner from the university. Now, the issue is that the question was raised, so there's nothing stopping from using legal financial instruments, whether it's a stock exchange or whatever else. But the question that was raised in the submissions was spin-off companies. Now, there is a very substantive policy issue that one is to deal with. I mean, if you look at the list that the Higher Education and Training Network provided, where one of the universities has something like 9 or 10 companies that they own. Now, the issue is, what are the nature of these companies? Who's the shareholders? What is the statutory obligation of these companies to be able to ensure that they comply with the Higher Education Act? And we think it's very tenuous that we have to really look at it. Now, the second argument that has been raised is that, no, it allows us to exploit the intellectual property that we have created as a state, that through state funds have been created. But the Intellectual Property Act is very clear. If any intellectual property, patents, etc., produced with funds of the state belongs to the state, except in the case of university, the state allows the university to exploit it to the fullest. And if the university is unable to exploit it, it must revert back, the patents, etc., must revert back to the state. The state can do what it through. Now, I think there needs to be a cogent argument as to what is it that the Higher Education Act prohibits universities from doing. What is it that if they start up a company, set up the directors, either with council knowledge or without council knowledge, because that company will be subject to the Companies Act, and we as education or the minister cannot interact with that company because it will be against King III and governance principles. So the issue is, it was in the earlier version, correct, in the version that was consulted, and it was pointed out, and in fact the word is unfortunate, the word is used as spin-offs and beneficiation. If there's an argument that you cannot do anything, you cannot increase the resources, the purchasing income of a university without establishing a company. So, Chairperson, that's the response, is that we have to undertake a real due diligence around this matter before trying to make it legal when it may just not be legal.
Assist me to round up the meeting. Thank you very much. Mr. Honourable Member Mbata.
I know that there was a response by the department when it came to the suggestion of extending cancers from in particular, specifically driving the extending of the numbers in favor of the student, moving the student from 2 to 3. You indicated that inherently that affects the other percentages of the internal stakeholders. But I don't think the argument should be arrested there. I think we should be able, as a portfolio committee, to interrogate what really makes the university to tick. And who are the stakeholders that have been left silent over a period of time? And the consequences of that silence have brought us consequences that we are not proud of. And maybe by extending representation, the intention of representation is actually to try and bring those voices even stronger without having to kill the principles of extending the councils overall. So I'm trying to say, Chair, I still have a feeling that the department is using one other suits all solution. I think you must interrogate us. because even in the initial act contributions or hearings of 1995, there was one draft suggested for the LRC, and those who were students then argued for two. And I mean, this is now like 22 years later. I think we are seeing the developments of inherently hunters making students' voice dead in either hunters or in many other what we call representative forums. So I'm not convinced that we're making a genuine case. I still feel that within the internal stakeholders, there is one group who can select and say, we need to make sure that this group is represented extensively. No, I don't want a response yet. Yeah.
Engagement. Let me thank the minister and the deputy minister for making time for us. I know they are very busy, but this time they also have given us their time. We call it quality time. And indeed, when the minister and the deputy minister join us in these meetings, it makes us to be even more effective, because of the quality inputs and clarity on some of the issues that need them to provide. I would also like to thank the DG and the department's officials for the work that you have done. Firstly, for coming, but also you have brought responses. We will be leaving this meeting with clear responses to the issues that were raised by the different stakeholders in their submissions. As we are sitting here, we are clarified on the issues that were raised, but also the follow-up questions that we raised with you. You provided the clarity that we needed. Is this committee, and we are empowered to go back and do our work. I have no doubt in my mind that indeed we will give it our best shot. You have enabled us to go back and work and rework on the bill, and then make I'll say quality inputs that will make this bill or that will make the bill to pass the order of the day. I think we are very happy also with the submissions that we made, and coming from or flowing from the submissions, there is support for the bill. I haven't heard anyone who says I don't support this bill. So the bill is supported. But then as we deliberate on the bill, we will then come back to the department on maybe our proposals to include maybe new, you know, clauses, or, but we will come back to you. And we welcome also your inputs or where you have identified gaps. We will consider that, and then we'll then take a decision as a committee on whether to include or to exclude. But thank you for helping us see today where you identified gaps yourself. And all right, and then otherwise we are ready, I think, for the next meeting. And the next meeting will then be considering the bill clause by clause. And I want to believe that you will also be part of it, of that meeting where we will be considering the bill clause by clause. Because Honourable Professor, is there any dissenting view?
Chair, I'm not sure where the department, in terms of procedure, is supposed to be in that discussion. Just a procedural point.
You know, why are they expecting? It's because they're saying nothing about us without us, you know? So they will then be observing without, am I right? It is a procedural matter. Not members of the public. Key stakeholders. In terms of your key three report, you've been identified as the key stakeholder. So you will be invited, you will be there to observe as we consider. Honourable Member, when I speak and you also want to speak, I get a little bit disturbed, but it's fine. You can come in, Honourable Member Kilia.
Sorry, Chairperson, I was not intended to.
Apology accepted.
No, I just want to say that it is very important for departmental officials to be.
Can you please raise your voice?
All I'm saying is, where it is our bill as a committee, because it's now in the legislative sector.
That's what I mentioned earlier on.
Yeah, but the fact is, it is good to have the department on hand.
Okay.
Because observing, but also on occasion, we may pose questions to them to assist us to see whether a matter is captured in other legislation that we should link, you know, the Amendment Act to. So I think it would be imperative for them to be present. I just want to support you on that.
Thank you very much. So it is then clear that we are leaving an unfinished business, as we will be meeting again next week Wednesday to take the work to another level. Now, maybe this will also be formally communicated to the department. We request the department to prepare a document for the committee that shows how the finalized draft bill will look like. This one is the advocate. I'm sure you understand what's needed here. Is advocate?
Chair, the department obviously will work with the parliamentary legal advisor and the state advisor to affect any decision taken or any instruction given by the committee in order to amend any provision in the bill. So the department will provide that assistance, and at the moment there is a number of issues that the department proposed. That is the status to it. The committee must first engage on it and identify specific aspects that must be amended. And based on that, what they call an able and the able will then be drafted and will feed into the process where the committee will take decisions on it.
Okay. I'm sure if Ms. Wheeler has a person, just to clarify my understanding of the request. At this stage, my understanding is that the chairperson is asking is for when the members are deliberating on a clause to clause by clause, they need to, for example, for ease of reading, have the provisions, the amended provisions of the Principal Act, including the new provisions, so to speak. So it's more or less the original bill that was introduced in Parliament, including the, for example, if you look into clause 3, there are part of clause 3 that will still read into the end product. So in order for them to be able, because if you look into the public submission, there are a lot of issues where there will be questions, because you didn't go to the Principal Act to read the Principal Act together with the amended bill, so that they don't work on two different documents. And then obviously the next day will be out of the deliberations will sit, and then we look into the amendments that are necessary or the committees that read upon. That's my understanding of what the person was talking about. Thank you.
Just to check if the department now follows what is needed to further assist the committee.
Yes, okay, we will provide it, and we will also work with this parliamentary advisor on the formulation to this. So, but there will be a document at the next meeting.
Now, I see the deputy minister is here. Otherwise, I see the engagements are done until next week, Wednesday. Just want to find out from the deputy minister if he has anything to add or just to. Okay. All right. No, that's fine. Yeah, no, that's okay. All right, we will then move on to the next item, whereby the department was asked to at least brief us on the protests that are taking place
just give us information how many more universities have joined and the contingency plan by the department, you know, to try and cap the situation so that we can normalize the situation at universities and have the teaching and learning going on there, because that is the core business of the university.
No, thank you very much, Chair, on this matter. Just briefly, I think in reference to the current issues at some of our universities, not in all of them, so that the institutions that are affected, it's University of Pretoria, University of Free State, Northwest, to Northwest University, to a very large extent. Well, not institutions, there are issues really that are ongoing, pertaining to issues that would be pertinent to a particular university. But let me start by saying that on the 16th of April 2015, the minister met with the vice chancellors and chairs of council of former African universities in the country. And there were intense engagements in there at a directive by the minister to actually attend to issues that are perceived or are discriminatory in nature in the practices of this institution. And one of them was the question of language. And the minister was quite emphatic into saying no language can be used as a means to deny access of any grouping, you know, in the country. And subsequent to that, there has been engagement with individual institutions in so far as attending to all those pertinent issues. Now, if I may move just to the recent events in some of these institutions. When this protest broke up at the University of Pretoria, we immediately engaged with the institution because we were guaranteed of the processes in place insofar as ensuring that the instruction in the letters is carried out in English. Now, we got a response from the institution, from the management, that at the institution presently, all classes are in English with some undergraduate programs offered in both English and Afrikaans. And according to the institution, there is no student who is denied access on the basis of language. That is at UP. Now further, the university has commissioned an investigation on the question of the language policy of the institution, which came up with recommendations, of which the senior of the institution said in January this year to look at the recommendations, and it endorsed that all lectures are to be offered in English only. That is the University of Pretoria. Afrikaans and Sepedi are to be used in providing additional support to students in tutorials, practicals, and discussions. And this is going to be engaged in the council meeting to be taking place, I think, on the 18th of March this year. That is this proposal and the recommendations from the Senate as they are coming out from the Commission. It's important to clarify this matter in respect to the processes. And I've been personally there in engaging with the management in respect to this question in the past few days. Now, the account then that the institution is giving, or these institutions are giving, is that the challenge they have
is that in the name, one, these protests are driven by groups not the democratically elected structure of students themselves within these institutions. These groupings of students were undermined as athletes, undermined any structure, would not observe any rules of institutional governance or protocols within the institution. Now, then, in order for them to be heard, what they do, the views that they have, they impose on others violently. That is their demand. They impose them violently. And you would understand the university is a place ready for academic activities. They don't have a force which is on a standby to intervene if there is any thing or disruption. No, they are not a national key point. They are institutions for free academic activity, you know, etc. Now, what I think perhaps would be important, especially from the members of the portfolio committee, I would have loved Honorable Mbata to be here.
Chairperson, why is Honorable Mbata being
asked? When these things are happening, because at times we are accused as a department, as well as a ministry, of not doing anything, yet there is a law that we are doing within the law. Is the expectation that if there is a protest in an institution, the minister must put that institution under administration? Is it what is expected? And what it actually means by not attending to this matter? What is the expectation so that we can understand really? And I'm serious on this question, because it's creating a lot of illusions in respect to how the universities are regulated in relation to the department, and how then, when there are issues, engagement should actually unfold, and what supportive mechanisms should we undertake at a given point in time. And as of yesterday, then the institution came up to say the problem that they are having is from, in the name, political parties outside the institution into these universities and campuses, and begin to engage in a manner which is acrimonious in contestation of whatever issues that they are contesting. That's what the management sent to me from UP in the main. I have that on email, and they have also followed up in discussion. And they are actually asking, in situations like this, what should we be doing? Because now we are being made a political football as a university, and it is not our competence to engage in a political terrain. We are here as mere academics with a particular purpose of teaching and educating, you know, our kids. But we are subjected to this kind of practices. And I don't know as to whether, in relation to the autonomy, when is being alleged that or demanded from the department, no, you must act, what form of action should actually be taking place? Taking into consideration the autonomous nature of the institution. I was expecting the deputy minister, the minister, to go there and say to an institution, I'm giving you a directive now. From this hour, you are under administration and taking over and running this institution, all its operations. Or perhaps there's something that we may be thinking about that could be of advice in relation to that. And also, when a particular grouping or any individual is using violence to make his point or her point of views or demands to be met, what these institutions should actually be doing, what the department should be doing in those areas. You know, The situation is a big conflict one, and we really agree that the acrimony with which it goes is not something really that belongs to an institution of higher learning. And we impress upon, of course, as a department, that it is important for a university management as well as council to consider and engage on all issues that are put into their attention. And concrete action has to be determined out of those processes. So we are in engaging and we are in support of the processes that are looking at finding a resolution in all these matters, whether it's Free State or it's the University of Northwest or Pretoria. These are the issues that I think are quite important for our consideration. And in some instances, not everything really is racial in nature, but at times it would be portrayed, you know, as such. Whilst in the main, it's a matter that if it could be afforded an opportunity, at least by the university management, to look at it, process, and act on it within a reasonable time frame, there would be resolutions that are obtained, you know, in those institutions. And the other thing is that these institutions, they get subjected, you know, to these kinds of practices. But largely, they are headed by black vice chancellors. They are headed by black vice chancellors. And I think it's important for all of us to give these vice chancellors the respect they deserve. All of us. And of course, where we disagree with them, we have to do that in a very dignified manner that is looking at the arising at resolution of this matter. So we are working on all these issues quite intensely, hour by hour, and we are getting briefings on daily basis with the institutions, and we are there to support them towards resolving all the outstanding matters that are of contention at the present moment. Thank you very much.
Remember that you just asked for just a briefing, summary briefing, because we actually had not informed the department to prepare this. So this is a briefing. And then as this committee, we would like to be updated on the developments, because our interest is to see those institutions having normalized, and also the culture of teaching and learning going on there, so that I know that one of your strategic objectives is to increase your input so that you can achieve on that objective, and also quality education. People can acquire quality education from those institutions. So I know members, but there was a media statement, a media released by the department that you have circulated, so you can also read what the department is saying. You can also use this one just for your own, for your information. And then in the next meeting, I'm sure if there's more, we will then get that report, the updated report. I see the Deputy Minister would like to say something.
I think the DG has covered all the issues. I just wanted to ask you, you know, this matter is very serious, and it does not require any form of posture. Yesterday I sat in the House in the National Assembly, and Professor Pozzoli made a statement to say, well, universities are planning and the minister is missing in action. And then the teacher just posed the question, what form of action we expected is expected of us, number one. And she knows that universities are autonomous, for instance, and we may not have the powers to intervene in a manner that is perhaps expected of us. But also, it's a pity that Honorable Mbata has just left the room. You know, Chair, some of the utterances that are made by political leaders, they, you know, they have a potential of escalating this thing and worsening it. Now, and especially from political parties represented in Parliament, in this committee, I think perhaps there should be emphasis from the side of the committee, the trio chair, formal statements, all of that, to really call on political parties to act and speak responsibly as we're dealing with this matter. It was a very sensitive issue, and it cannot be that we make utterances that will exacerbate this thing that is happening at our institutions of higher learning. It's very bad. It's a serious matter that we are really trying. But we are there, the DG saying, the officials are in constant communication with institutions. They are on the ground. They are trying to provide whatever support to the institutions. But political parties have to assist us. The way they communicate, the way they... And because also our student movements that are affiliated to some of the political parties that are represented in the parliament, I think the time has come now that we equally engage the student structures, this political student political structures, so that they too, in the course of pursuing the struggles of students, they do this responsibly, without really calling for what I would personally call a bloodshed, because it will lead to that. If we do not curtail what is happening, it will lead to a bloodshed, and that would be unfortunate not only for higher education in South Africa, but generally for our country, because it will move from the institutions of higher learning and it will get to community, and it will be just a very bad situation. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, all the DA has been calling for is the department to say the kind of things that you said here now and that the minister said in his statement. Because the country feels out of touch with what's happening in universities. Nobody is suggesting that university autonomy be breached. But that the country as a whole be informed, maybe, as the deputy minister said, we are in constant touch. We are in okay with what's happening. We are assisting. None of this was conveyed until yesterday in a brief form. Perhaps in an emergency situation like this, regular communiques from the minister need to be issued. This is what is meant by absent, that there's a kind of vacuum of information. Nobody really knows what's going on. Nobody really knows that the ministry really is on the side of a peaceful, regulated solution to these things. All some of the things the minister said yesterday do not engage in gratuitous violence, those sorts of things. So I think we're all on the same side in wanting a peaceful solution to these problems, but I do think the absence of the ministry was felt, and one understands that you're very busy doing things behind the scenes, but ordinary people in the public sphere do not know this. So that is all. Thank you.
I just want to bring to the notice that indeed what Professor Bozzelli is saying is constructive, is positive. But the other problem is that, for example, this morning on SASM, when I was traveling on the bus from that 9 o'clock talk show, SASM talk show from 8 to 9, the minister was there interviewed and explaining the same thing. So we should be careful when we make statements, because when the minister responds, you could have missed that, and you take it that he's not responding. So I'm just saying that you be careful, because it was when I can tell you we're listening there, though in the past, because of the attitude of political parties, others were making noise to quieten what we're listening to. But I'm saying the minister is doing everything possible. And whenever there's this type of a thing, I know he appears in the news and he makes statement, he try and explain the situation. But by and large, he doesn't. That what was only saying, we appreciate it. Honorable, but process is honorable enough.
To be honest, everybody is concerned about the disruption at the institutions of higher learning. Okay. And they think it's something to be emulated. Please don't expand this debate, because all right, I will see. All of us are really concerned about this disruption. All that, maybe the underlying message of what was being said here is that let us try and not aggravate the situation. In the Bible, it is said that we've got to, when we were children, we behave as children, but now that we are old, we understand like others. As adults, we must remain in these good role models for our youth, for our children, because they look up to us. So let's not aggravate. Where we can, let's reduce the problem. We need the institutions of higher learning, and we need our children to benefit from those institutions of higher learning. And the whole world out there waiting for them to come and take this nation to greater heights. So thank you very much. So, okay, we are done. There's tea at the back. I'm so sorry, the way these engagements were in, the way these engagements were interesting. I even forgot to announce that there's tea served, and tea, help yourself to tea. Otherwise, this will be a wasteful expenditure. That's where the PFMA comes in. Wasteful expenditure. Yeah. But there, to the honorable members, I just want to check if you still form a forum. Forum is formed by how many people? Six, ne? And we are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right. I'm sorry, we will then not violate the rules. Shall we then again, and then all the matters that are on just approval of the minutes, and then the structure and the committee structure endorsement or adoption of the structure, and that's all. So it's what that has already been done, we just needed, but members must just go and go over them again, and then so that next time when you find time we then adopt. The meeting stands are changed. Please, food is served today, even if it's a lunch, finger lunch.